Wow.
What's up?
I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
Where'd you get those shoes?
Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
There's one thing that will forever change the way you sleep, and it's the softest 100% organic cotton sheets from Boll & Branch. You'll fall asleep faster, wrapped in the most luxurious comfort. You'll never sleep hot again with sheets that feel breathable to sleep in. You'll experience the purest softness on night one and feel your sheets get even softer with every wash. Discover the difference with 15% off your first set of sheets at BollandBranch.com with code Odyssey. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Right, back at the Jeff Calkins Show. Let's do this Chris Harrington deal. Chris Harrington joins me now. Chris, what are we listening to?
That is Wrap It Up by Sam and Dave. The superior, I think, B-side to one of their biggest hits, I Thank You. We talked a little bit about Sam and Dave yesterday, but my Central Memphis Library entry on the best of Sam and Dave went up after the show. So
I've tweeted that out, and your piece, you've already written about the Grizzlies and their loss last night to Houston. I've tweeted that out as well. People can read that over at the Daily Memphian. So, Chris, are you anxious to fire Taylor Jenkins for the way he deployed his players in the final moments in the fourth quarter of that game?
I am not at all. I mean, you know, it's funny, when yesterday we talked about the Minnesota game, which was a close game down the stretch. I could have gone either way, and how the Wolves fans up here were like apoplectic about the loss and hated all their players and wanted to fire their coach and like were in a complete meltdown because Ja Morant made a tough shot and Anthony Edwards missed a tough shot and their team lost the game. That's just how it goes. Like when you expect your team to be good, you have reason to expect your team to be good because your team is good. You sort of expect your team to always win, and then people get mad when they lose, and so there it goes. I think there's stuff to talk about from that game. I wrote about some of it, but I didn't watch that game and say this was a total failure of coaching. No, that was not okay. My reaction to
Let
the game.
Let me just bring up, though, well, since we're on the topic, the two things that I have heard. One is, weirdly enough, and the timeout stuff wasn't a big talking point afterwards, but it is kind of interesting. Last game against Houston, he calls the timeout, criticizes himself for calling the timeout when the Grizzlies trailed by three. This time, he did not call the timeout when he could have called a timeout to advance the ball. He had two timeouts at that point, could have called the timeout to advance the ball over half court. And I don't know, I actually thought there was an argument for calling the timeout this time, and you can inbound to someone maybe in more of a shooting position, maybe, you know, Houston's going to foul at that point because that's their history. What do you make of negotiating the timeouts?
Yeah, no. Now that I think about it, I didn't write about that. But I was surprised that, to me, that was the obvious, you call a timeout. It was after a free throw, right? There's like 9 seconds. And you call a timeout, you set up your play, you advance the ball. Yeah. No, I was surprised that didn't happen. I didn't see that as some like major thing, but I was surprised by it. The problem with the timeout in the game before wasn't like that he called it. It was the timing of the timeout.
Yep.
You know, if that timeout had been called the second the Grizzlies got possession, which is what we're talking about, you know, what might have happened last night, I don't think anyone would have really second-guessed that. It was he broke up the flow of a play that he incorrectly thought was not going to yield anything, you know?
Right. Yeah, I agree 100% on that. Okay, but then the bigger focus has been on the substitution patterns in particular. Ja comes out with 7:31 left in the game. The Grizzlies are up 103-94. Jaren then goes out with 7 minutes left in the game for Brandon Clark. Grizzlies are still up 103-95. Jaren comes back, honestly, just a minute and 3 seconds later, by which time it's 105-102. Josh stays out till 4:57. He comes back in. It is down to a one-point game at that point. That's what people are circling.
So there's a few different things with that. Josh played 37 minutes.
Most of the season.
Season high. It's his third game back from a shoulder injury. He was on the list questionable with illness that day. Like, I assume people aren't questioning the 37 minutes. They're questioning, like, where they're apportioned, right?
Seems to be.
And this gets back to, like, one of my, like, broken record hobby horse things that I can keep talking about, but, like, no one ever really – people just – it's impossible to get to internalize it, is that the fourth quarter is not a magical time where the baskets count twice. It's what they do earlier in the game. It's a narrative illusion that it matters more in the fourth quarter. If the game's close, it feels like it does because you're closer to the end, but, like, it doesn't actually matter more.
Right.
And so
would they have been up if Ja's presence is key, would they have been up by 9 when he went out?
Did they build that 13 point lead with 10 to go? If you subtract those minutes from when he played the third quarter, right? I got some issues with that. To me, the better question, and as far as the Jaren thing, like, he played 30 minutes, which is above his season high. But his season average, but it's lower than what's been his recent norm. And the reason his minutes weren't higher was because they overreacted to the fouls, right?
Right.
Well, he had 5. So if you play him one more second, maybe he fouls out. But I'd just as soon find out, you know? This gets back to the fourth quarter thing. You're saving him because you believe the fourth quarter stuff is more important. I think fans and coaches, I'm the lone, like, you know, like weirdo out, like, yelling at clouds about this, but I just think that it's, I think it impacts everyone who looks at the game, and I think it's wrong for the most part. To me, the real thing you could point to, and it's super easy to point to it when they lose, right? They win the game, no one's questioning this. But if you're going to have to break up your three top players,
right?
Desmond Bane, Ja Morant, and Jaren Jackson at some points during the game. Now, what he did differently in this game relative to the game in Memphis that they lost is that he did stagger them. You go back to that game in Memphis that they lost, there was a stretch there where Morant, Jackson, and Bane were all on the bench. And I think that is not how this team should play in playoff quality basketball. And so he corrected that, and I do think it's a correction. So what he did with this one was when he break, and we're going to break them up, you're going to have stretches where at least two were on the bench. No matter how you do this, even if you stagger them, there's always going to be stretches where only one of the three are out there. And it was only 2 minutes, and it was Bane, right? And it went poorly. And that's mostly on the players. Like, you got to be able to survive 2 minutes with Ja Morant and Jaren Jackson out of the game. But I do think you could argue that if you're going to, when you break them up, like the one-man standing lineups, might be better with either Ja or Jaren as the one man than Bane. Because Ja is a guy who's the best ball handler or shot creator you have.
Right.
He's also better at sort of getting shots for other people. So if you're going to have one guy by himself, Ja sort of makes sense. Well, Jaren's become your best ISO scorer. And so, like, you'd have lineups where, like, you just, like, let ISO Jaren for 2 minutes, right?
Right.
I do think if you're going to have only one of the three out there, the least functional of those different paths is probably the Bane path. So that is something I think you can question, but it's super easy to question just because it didn't work out in that game.
Right. Okay. So there was, and as you pointed out in your piece, there was good news here. It was, well, there was a bunch of good news, honestly. Like, it was, I think, what you called the best loss, the best of the three losses to the Rockets. It was also, by the way, Desmond Bane looked like Desmond Bane.
Yeah, no, he's been generally better. He had a really bad stretch for a few weeks when he first came back from the injury. And he's had other stretches since then where, like, he'll be quiet for a quarter or for a half, and then he'll come through. But, no, he had a good game. And he had a stretch there, like, he got mad at Dylan Brooks. And, like, that got him fired up. And that was fun to watch. No, I think, you know, generally speaking, you could nitpick, certainly. Generally speaking, all three of the main guys were good. Like you know, they're on the road against a really good team that presents specific, I think, matchup problems for them right now. And they lost by two. And they lost by two in a game. And you could say, well, they hit the meaningless shot. Whatever. So they lost by five. Like, same difference. It was anybody's game in the last minute. You lose a nip-and-tuck game on the road against a really good team that presents matchup problems. And only in a game where, frankly, Jalen Green was having one of those nights. He does not do that all the time, but he is capable of having those kind of games.
Right.
Well, he's just hitting stupid shots. He's hitting, like, fadeaway threes from the corner with two guys all over him. Like, what are you doing, you know?
I agree with that. That's a point I made earlier. That Jalen Green is not what the rest of the league sees every night. That is not Jalen Green. Here's the question, partly, though, is that do the Grizzlies, particularly missing Vince Williams and Marcus Smart, and what are they more susceptible to those? Like, I mean, they struggle with Sengun. They also struggle with the athleticism and the perimeter players on Houston.
I think that Green and Amen Thompson together is a real problem.
Right.
I think the Grizzlies, you know, caught a break in these last two games because Tari Eason has been out. And that's another guy who's a particular problem, I think. I think that the Rockets have a lot of athleticism at the wing and forward spots and a lot of toughness overall. You throw Dylan Brooks into that mix. I think the Grizzlies, as deep as they are and as talented as they are, they do not have a ton of athleticism and size at wing forward. They are not the most athletic team in the league. They've actually sort of gone the other way. I've talked about that in the past, so like who's catching Jaws lobs anymore, you know? They're not the most athletic team either. I think that's where the matchup issues come in. But I do think, and I posted this last night, I miss Vince Williams all the time because I just like the way he plays. But I think this matchup in particular, I think, is where they've missed him most. And if you go beyond him, you look at the three guys who have been out the most this season, Marcus Smart, Vince Williams, G.G. Jackson. Like, you talk about toughness and athleticism on the wing and at forward. Like, Marcus Smart, is for all the issues, he does supply that toughness. G.G. Jackson, for all the uncertainty, does supply that athleticism in a way that other guys on the roster don't. And I think Vince Williams gives you both. And I think you really miss those guys in that particular matchup.
They all look like they could be Rockets. You know, like all
this is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I think Vince Williams is the most Houston Rockets player on the Grizzlies roster.
Yeah, and if we were talking about it earlier, the sports talk bar, who do you want now? Who's the toughest Grizzly? Like, who do you? And I think Marcus Smart and Vince Williams Jr., you know, maybe are one and two, or in whatever order, right? Like, and Zach Edey may be up there, who knows, at this point, although Draymond Green says he's fake tough. Anyway, does it feel, I don't know, it can feel... A little bit, yeah. Wait till we got Marcus Smart and Vince Williams Jr. back. Well, first of all, they haven't been back. And then second of all, even when they have been, like Marcus Smart has been not necessarily great.
Yeah.
And Vince Williams Jr. looked rusty is what he looked like. And he's only, I presume, more rusty, right?
I don't know if the Grizzlies need both of those guys. I do think they need one of those guys in their rotation. And hopefully if you only need one, the odds of getting one of the two is better than getting two. I do think this team is a physical, like, perimeter defender short, and you got two options on the bench. Hopefully one of them will come through for you, although it is not guaranteed. I would say that, like, it looks like more of an issue against this matchup than some others, and this is not, like, every game you play. You got one more of these in the regular season. I do think, stepping back, sort of broadly speaking, I think this little stretch has been a little bit of a reminder, maybe a little bit of a come down. Like, no one coming into the season thought the Grizzlies are going to run away with being the second seed in the West. The Thunder are going to run away with one. The Grizzlies are run away from everyone else. They had a nice stretch there, you know, game 15 through game 35 or whatever it was, where, like, the hot air balloon floated them up to two. And now they're starting to dip back down a little bit. Oh, they're still third. I think the reality is, like, the Thunder are going to run away with the West more than likely in the regular season. Two through three, four, five, six, maybe seven, eight. Like, that's just going to be a hotly contested stretch. And, like, the Grizzlies could finish anywhere in that stretch depending on how things go. And you watch these recent games, like, I think they played eight straight games against playoff contenders in the West. And one of those games was a double-digit loss. One was a double-digit win. And all the rest of them have been up-for-grab games down the stretch. And I think there's going to be a lot of that.
Grizzlies win total before the season, I looked it up again today. I think it was 47.5, and they are, you know, they're on a 50-52. Whatever. If they beat San Antonio, they'll be on a 52-win pace halfway through the season. So, yes, they are, in fact, overachieving, even in the face of injuries. 2 points that you brought up in your piece that I wanted to ask you about. One was that the offense, particularly against better teams, doesn't look necessarily like Taylor Jenkins would want it to look.
Yeah, I think for the Ja Morant assist number in particular to me is an indicator. It's like a leading indicator, or maybe it's a trailing indicator. I don't know. I didn't pay that much attention in economics class, but it's one of those things for like the Grizzlies' general success. And in the 3 games since he's been back, he has more turnovers than assists. I don't think that's all on Ja. It may not even be primarily on Ja. But it's sort of an indicator of sort of the way the team is flowing and functioning, where you're not getting the transition buckets, you're not getting the easy stuff, you're not getting the alley-oops, like things are harder. Things are going to be harder against the better defenses, but I think, you know, it's got to be a mix. You're going to scale back and have more one-on-one against those teams anyway, just because they're better. But you got to flow better than you've been flowing. And so that's a real challenge for them, to get their offensive flow going a little bit better against these better defenses. And Houston in particular has just forced them, and like turnovers have been a problem all season, but they've been a bigger problem against Houston.
Of course, now they forced a bunch of turnovers from Houston as well, but it felt like, yes, Houston was getting easier shots in the fourth quarter, honestly. Houston was 11 of 16 in the fourth quarter. You couldn't stop them. But
Houston shouldn't be getting easier shots.
Right.
This is the thing. Like,
yeah.
The Grizzlies should have a better functioning offense than the Rockets based on their talent.
And then you wrote a little section about Zach Edey as well. What are you thinking these days about Zach Edey?
Yeah, I don't think that was a particularly big deal in last night's game, but it's sort of a general trend. I think Edey's sort of getting lost in the mix a little bit. I got some numbers on that in the piece I wrote over the last 5 games, where he hasn't taken many shots, period. But even in the context of that, like, they're mostly three-pointers and putbacks. The idea of just getting him touches, like, you know, catch the ball in some kind of shooting position or position to make a play within the structure of the offense has just stopped. And so I think, and part of this is on him, right? You know, you got to make yourself available. You got to make yourself a target. You got to know how to move within the offense. But I think that they have done a bad job, and they include Edey, just the team has done a bad job of getting him involved and keeping him involved in the offense. And so you think about the NBA cliche of, like, you know, Kendrick Perkins OKC, like, first play of the game, just throw the ball to him, let him do whatever he wants to do because you need to get him engaged. Like, the whole, like, you know, get the big man involved early thing is kind of a cliche, but maybe for a reason, right? I think they should probably put a little bit more effort into getting Edey involved.
Your other piece today was about, and again, we talked yesterday about Sam and Dave. Sam died last week, but you entered one of their albums in your Essential Memphis library. What is it?
It is The Best of Sam and Dave, and there's probably like lots of albums called The Best of Sam and Dave, but this is the first one called The Best of Sam and Dave. So it is a compilation that came out in 1969. So it's right sort of at the end of their stretch with Stax. So it's sort of a best of their Stax era. The original pressing on vinyl is 14 songs. You know, you can find some streaming or CD versions that probably have bonus stuff on it. But the original version of that is 14 tracks, all from their Stax era, all the classics, all the hits. And it's great stuff.
So I don't know if contemporaneously, if Soul Man was the biggest hit. It's the one that we now no, because of all the other stuff, right? And it is, as you point out, it's almost sort of cliche. I don't know if it's over whatever,
right?
But what do you hear when you hear that song? What tell me about that song.
It became a template for like the Blues Brothers, basically. The whole Blues
right.
Brothers shtick was like,
yeah,
a Sam and Dave rip. And then since then, it's become like almost like a civic booster anthem kind of thing. That song is written by David Porter. David Porter's still with us. Long, you know, lifelong Memphian. Shout out to David Porter. He wrote the lyrics for that song. That song is written was almost kind of a manifesto, like a soul philosophy manifesto, right? Got what I got the hard way. I'll make it better each and every day. It was less about the music than about sort of, you know, the grit and grind lifestyle before we called it that a little bit. But I think musically, that record's just exciting. Like, go back and listen to that record sometime and, like, listen close during the transitions. When they come out of a chorus into a verse, or out of a verse into a chorus, and then back out of the chorus back into a verse. There's a little like 5-6 second gaps in there. There's just all kinds of stuff going on, like guys shouting at each other, little guitar licks, little bass licks. Just the sense of interplay going on that record to me is really exciting to listen to.
What was Steve Cropper's role in all of this? A session musician?
He was a session musician, producer, and songwriter. Like the Stax sort of house community, like there's just a lot of creative people who had different roles at different times. And Cropper was, for a while, was sort of Jim Stewart's right-hand man. So he got involved in engineering, producing, helping run sessions really early. So he was a guitar player and a lot of that stuff. He also did a lot of production, sort of just session work, you know, engineering session work on that stuff. And then he started to get involved in songwriting, too, and wrote a lot of songs. So he was involved in all kinds of ways.
So they brought him here from Miami. And
Sam and Dave.
Not Steve Cropper. Yeah, Sam and Dave, they brought that. Yeah, Sam and Dave came from Miami to cut records with Stax. How long was their tenure here, and what ultimately happened to Sam and Dave?
It was about 4 or 5 years, probably. I think it was 65 when Jerry Wexler, who ran Atlantic Records, had signed them. And Atlantic Records had a business relationship with Stax. They would bring people. He brought Wilson Pickett to Memphis, although Pickett stuff was not released on Stax. He did sessions here. He brought Sam and Dave to Stax to see if, you know, they could have more success with them than they'd had before. It clicked, and it worked great for several years. And then in 68, it wasn't a Sam and Dave thing as much as an Atlantic Records thing. When the Atlantic Records Stax business relationship ended then. And since Sam and Dave were technically Atlantic artists, not Stax artists, when Atlantic ended their relationship with Stax, that took Sam and Dave away from Stax. And they never had the same success after that.
All right. You can read Chris's piece on the Grizzlies last night and on Sam and Dave over at the Daily Memphian. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right. We're going to take a break. I'm sorry to report no Fish on Friday on Tuesday today. He could not be with us. I've tapped my son, Peter, to fill in. He used to be known as our analytics department. I don't know if he qualifies anymore. Like, I don't know how immersed he is. He is a devout watcher of the Grizzlies and has some other interesting thoughts. We're going to talk to him, pinch hitting for Fishman, when we return. It is the Jeff Calkins Show, 92.9 FM ESPN.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed's sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
So it's a new year, 2025, and you're thinking, how am I going to make this year different? How am I going to build something for myself? But where do I start? Shopify is how you're going to make it happen, and here's how. Shopify makes it simple to create your brand, open for business, and get your first sale. The best time to start your new business is right now. Get your store up and running easily with thousands of customizable templates, no coding or design skills required. All you need to do is drag and drop. Their powerful social media tools let you connect all your channels and create shoppable posts and help you sell everywhere people scroll. What happens if you don't act now? Will you regret it? What if someone beats you to the idea? Don't kick yourself when you hear this again in a year because you didn't do anything now. With Shopify, your first sale is closer than you think. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to start selling with Shopify today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
But dude averages 18 yards after catch.
We get it. When you're passionate about something, you go all in. You live entirely in that world. That's exactly how Graybar is about renewable energy projects.
He's all fourth quarter, such a
sleeper. Join our league of clean energy at graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps. And after that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott is presented by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, football fans, it's Andrew Filippone, host of the First and Pod podcast. Join me and my co-host, three-time All-Pro Patrick Peterson, as we break down every game every week. New episodes drop on Monday and Friday mornings. Be sure to subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, normally on Tuesdays, we talk to our man in Washington, D.C., Charles Fishman. He is not available today, so alas. So I've called on my own son, Peter Calkins, to join the show. Peter graduated from Duke this past May, and then he's been working with his brother on Ready Golf, which is, what is Ready Golf, Peter? Explain Ready Golf to the people.
Yeah, so it's a golf simulator. It's in New York City. It's in East Village. It's 3rd and 2nd Avenue. And basically, you go in, it's kind of scan in, scan out with your phone. It's fully autonomous. And there's two bays where you have these TrackMan golf simulators, you know, the best golf simulators money can buy, and you just get to go and hit balls for, you know, an hour or 2 hours, however long you book for, and we're basically, you know, the most affordable golf simulator in the city. So yeah, we just opened like 2 weeks ago, so very exciting stuff.
What's it like launching a business in New York City?
Oh, it's a huge thing. Just all sorts of just constant, you know, hassle. And the rent is just, it's crazy. The rent is like, you know, the overwhelming majority of the expense. But it's also exciting, you know.
So living in New York, and you're here now, but living in New York, two questions. One is rats, and one is subway. Let's discuss, here in Memphis, we think, Memphians tend to often think this is the worst place in the world. And whatever, Jeffrey, have you seen a rat? When's the last time you saw a rat?
Ooh. Carly killed a couple. It's been years.
It's been years?
Yeah.
Okay, so Peter, you were living in New York. How often would you see a rat?
Yeah, I mean, you basically see a rat every day. I mean, you know, there might be days. At nighttime, if I left my apartment at night, there was a 100% chance of me seeing a rat. At least one. And, like, often you'd see four or five. And honestly, seeing them isn't that bad. The worst part is hearing them, and you don't see them. You just hear them rustling around and, you know, chirping, and it feels like they could be anywhere. But, yeah, you see them constantly. It's just part of life. It's like squirrels, you know?
Urban squirrel. Okay.
Yeah.
Now the subway. The subway, I read recently. I mean, there was the horrific story recently about this woman who was lit on fire by someone in the subway. She was sleeping in a subway train. But then we also had, within the last month, someone who was just pushed in front of a subway train by a random-ass person. This stuff that happened in Memphis, we would think this is the worst place in the world. What's your experience with the subway in New York City?
Well, my experience is you know, overwhelmingly positive. Generally reliable, feels safe, you know, typically not too crowded, whatever. Like, there are delays, but it's not too bad. You know, I think you hear stories like that and you kind of feel like it just feels like surreal because that is such a crazy thing to happen, to be lit on fire on the subway.
That is crazy. Like, yes, right. Yes.
I've fallen asleep on the subway and I didn't wake up, you know, in flames. And it didn't even occur to me that it could. So it feels so, you know, it's such a big city. There's so many people that, you know, crazy stuff will happen. And when it happens, it almost feels like weirdly removed from your everyday life in a way that, you know, in a smaller city like Memphis, it doesn't to the same extent.
I was struck by, though, when I was there recently, that the sheer density of people creates a feeling of safety. Like,
Oh, totally.
Is that true?
Yeah, you feel safe because there's people everywhere. It totally makes you feel generally safe. Like, which is maybe an illusion because there's also so many people you get, you know, accustomed to just ignoring things, right? I mean, obviously there's, like, you know, like someone is crazy on the subway and everyone just ignores him, right? So maybe it's not as safe as you think you are, but it definitely makes you feel safe that, oh, there's all these, you know, bystanders everywhere and people, you know, here as spectators.
You're within throngs everywhere. It goes to the point, I wrote a column about how I wanted Memphians in 2025 to get out more. But one of the things is if we all get out more, density itself is in fact, I don't even think it's an illusion. I think there's studies that show the density itself creates more safety. Anyway, enough of New York.
That's 100% true.
Yeah. If people do want to, if they're in New York or friends in New York or whatever else, and they want to hit some golf balls in New York, which I guess you can't do. There's probably no golf courses in New York. How do people, where is Ready Golf? What's the website?
Yeah, it's www.ready-gc.com. That's our website if you want to go check it out. And then we also have an app just called Ready Golf Club. Okay. That you can book through.
All right. I wanted to get another perspective because people are up in arms about Taylor Jenkins and the Grizzlies last night. Big picture, as someone who follows this closely, where are you on the Grizzlies?
I feel optimistic. I mean, you know, obviously we talk regularly, as you're my dad. And so, you know, I've kind of had this feeling that the center position is kind of a weakness with, you know, Edie, who's had good moments, but he's also had bad moments. Clark, who's kind of a good player, but in some cases he's kind of situational, right? You don't want to feel like you have to play him all the time. If he's your best center, your go-to guy, maybe that limits you in some ways. And then obviously Huff is more of this kind of a fun guy who goes out there and, you know, makes cool plays, but isn't really a serious whatever. And so I still worry about that. That's something that can be an issue, particularly when you get to the playoffs and it's like, you know,
I want to get you back to your optimism in a minute. I want to put a pin in that one. You are not a Zach Edey believer.
No, I'm not.
Why?
I think, well, one, he's old. And so, like, to
old
extent,
for a rookie. Old for a rookie. He's not.
Yeah,
a rookie. Right, yeah.
So it's not like he goes out there and he has these nights where he just looks lost, where on offense he's turning the ball over constantly. He's picking up fouls. I mean, last night he had, you know, 6 fouls and 2 points. And it just feels like the game is way too fast for him. Like he just the pace of it, not just the physical athletic speed, but just mentally, he's not processing things, you know, fast enough. And he sometimes just gets lost on both sides of the ball. And it's like, this isn't a 19-year-old, you know, this isn't Gigi Jackson where it's like, yeah, he's going to make a bunch of mistakes, but you know, he's got all this runway. Like, you know, you generally don't improve as much when you're 22 as you do when you're.
But isn't this,
you know,
also experiential? Like, it's also his first year. Like, he wasn't that great his first year at Purdue either. I mean,
yeah, but like Brandon Clark, you know, he came in as an old rookie and he was amazing as a rookie. And since then, he's been basically, you know, most of the same player. And I think there are examples of guys getting better. I mean, Bain has certainly gotten much better, but even then, he
came in as an older guy, got better. Yep.
But he knew how to play. He got better because he, you know, added shots to his game. He worked on his handle. You know, he got better shooting off the dribble. He knew how to play as a rookie. And, you know, you look at a guy like Xavier Tillman. You know, he came in as a rookie. He was a good player. He was limited, but he knew how to play. He wasn't making mistakes. Like, I just feel when you have a guy who so clearly looks like he just can't keep up, I don't see that as a thing that's very likely to improve. I mean, feel is not something you can super easily teach.
I thought it was interesting, something you said, that we assumed he would be a problem offensively, right? And he's not.
I mean, that's the other thing. If you totally thought, okay, even if he struggles defensively, which is a little bit of a question mark, because in college he was in such a unique environment, you know, he was asked not to contest shots just so he wouldn't foul. It's just a very different game. We didn't know what to expect defensively, but we thought at least offensively, this guy will get in there and he'll be a problem. Teams will have to account for him. They'll have to defend him differently. And, like, he goes against the Rockets, who, like, their center is 6'9". Şengün is not a big, massive guy. They don't have a whatever. And he puts up 2 points. Like, the Rockets didn't have to account for him. They didn't have to worry about him offensively. And he's had good nights. But if you compare him even to someone like, you know, Jonas, who was on the team however many years ago, he was so much more of a problem offensively where, like, if you didn't account for him, he would kill you. He would put up 25 and, you know, 15. Edie, it's like if you don't account for him, maybe he'll give you 15 and 10. But a lot of times, he just won't. And it's like you could argue about how poor the defense has been, but the offensive impact that was kind of hypothetically
promised, right,
killed,
assumed, right.
He's clearly not there.
All right.
And it's inarguable, you know. The stats just are not there. He's not scoring enough. He's not getting enough offensive rebounds. He's turning it over too much. It just is not what it needs to be.
Offense, okay. Now back to your optimism. Okay, so you have some questions about the center position. Why do you feel good about the Grizzlies?
Oh, I just feel good because, I mean, they've been, you know, super hurt all year. And they've been killing teams, and they've been getting better. And obviously the last, you know, two losses to the Rockets are not great. But I just look at this as, like, this is clearly one of the four best teams in the West. They still have all these young players who are going to get better, guys like Jalen Wells, Gigi Jackson, whoever else, and they have all these picks. So, you know, maybe they don't make a move this year, but to kind of continue to improve the roster in the future. And, like, as it stands right now, the current version of the team, which is still missing players, is certainly a top four team in the West. Where there's really only one team that you feel you can't beat, that's OKC, and then it's like, well,
so you don't feel like that about Houston. Last night's game did not discourage you.
I mean, Jalen Green had 40 points, and the Rockets hit 52% of their threes. You know, I'm not saying we played amazing, but we lost by two in a game where the Rockets were just incredibly, incredibly hot.
That is not the Jalen Green that you're used to seeing.
No, I don't think Jalen Green is very good at all. I mean, it's like shoot, you know, he shoots 49% on twos and. You know, 35% on threes or whatever, and he scores 23 points, and he's bad on defense, and he doesn't get assists, and he doesn't get rebounds. And, you know, the good thing about him is sometimes he gets hot, but these games are, you know, few and far between compared to the games where he just isn't doing, you know, what you need him to do. Like, I don't think he, you know, is even one of the best five players, even though he starts, and I don't think he would start in the Grizzlies either. I think he had a great night, you know, props to him. I don't think he's that guy who, like, in a playoff series, you're like, we got to account for Jalen Green. I think he just had a good night.
So last night was, yeah, you would have liked to see him win, but you mostly chalk it up. How about the whole narrative of the Grizzlies are not physical enough to match up with the Rockets?
I mean, it's definitely clear this team is not that physical. And I think that's just part of how the team is. And there's things you get back in exchange for that, right? You're not as physical as the Rockets, but you also have guys like Ja Morant, Desmond Bane, Jaren Jackson Jr., who are all basically the three best players in the game, right? And so there's always trade-offs. There's always going to be against a team like the Rockets, who are a legitimately good team. There's going to be things they're better at and you're worse at. That's just part of it. At the same time, I think this also goes back to my thing about the center position, where someone like Edie, he's big, he's physical, but he's slow. He doesn't have much of an athletic presence. Someone like Clark, he's a little more athletic, whatever, but he's small. You know, he doesn't have that size on the inside, whatever. And I think if they had a center who was, you know, a little bit more of a factor, a guy who, you know, could be physical without being a total stiff, I think you would feel better about your physicality. And I think this is definitely a matchup where that shows, because the Rockets, one, they have Şengün, who's just such a monster. But then, two, they're aggressive about getting offensive rebounds. And they have all these guys who are just crazy athletes, like Amen Thompson and Tari Eason and, you know, Jayshon Tate and whoever else.
All right, shifting topics, and then we'll let you go. Bills-Ravens this weekend. First of all, on the Josh Allen-Lamar thing, you and I are biased. What's your analysis of who should be MVP?
I can't remove my bias out of it. It's just, I mean, there is a thing where, like, I personally will be mad when, you know, it looks like Lamar might win the MVP because we've seen these, you know, all-pro votes. Lamar got 30 of them. I will be mad seeing that Lamar has three MVPs and Josh has zero, when the reality is, through the majority of their careers, Josh has been the better player, right? He hasn't had the MVP season just because of every year maybe there's someone who just had an outstanding season, maybe the Bills lost too many games last year, threw too many interceptions, whatever it is. The reality is, if you look at their playoff resumes, it's not even close. One of these guys has been so much better than the other guy. And, you know, Lamar this year maybe had his best season ever, and so I get why people think he should win the MVP. It just will suck. It will suck to have your guy who you feel is so clearly better than the other guy, and he has none, and the other guy has three. Like, that will sting.
The other thing that will suck that I hate as a Bills fan is this game is now being described as a referendum between these two players. Like, whoever wins, see, told you so, right? And the truth
is ridiculous.
And the truth is, Lamar has dramatically the better team around him this year. He's got the better running back. He's got the better wide receiver. He's got 9 Pro Bowl players on that team. And so that's going to be the narrative. I mean, I'm, of course, always convinced the Bills are going to lose, and that's going to be the narrative when they win. Hell, take this past weekend. Lamar did everything he needed to do. Lamar was great. But Derrick Henry was the engine.
Yeah.
Josh is the engine. It is a different deal, and it'll irritate me too.
Yeah, I mean, Derrick Henry's going to have 150 yards and 2 touchdowns, and the Bills are going to lose, and everyone's going to go, see, told you so. Lamar is better than Josh. Why does the NFL media?
Right, wait a second. When you say that, you sound like me. Did I bequeath to you my pessimism as well? You just said Derrick Henry's going to have 150 yards, then the Bills are going to lose. That is a hell of a miserable way to go through life.
I mean, I think to one extent, I can't go in with expectations, or I'll just be crushed. But I think you did give it to me. I don't think by talking negatively, I think it's, you know, genetic. I think the same, whatever it is inside you that makes you just so horrified that the Bills are going to lose every single game they go into. You know, I have it too.
The anxiety. Yeah. It's the anxiety.
Does Ben share it?
I don't think it's bad.
Ben's much more optimistic.
It's funny how siblings are that way.
And then Peter's totally, and then Andrew's totally oblivious. Totally oblivious. Yeah. All right, Peter. We appreciate Ready Golf. How again? What if people going to New York City want to hit golf balls? Where do they go?
Yeah, www.ready-gc.com or download on the App Store Ready Golf Club.
All right. Thanks, Peter. Appreciate it.
Thanks,
Peter Calkins. It is funny. I knew that he's not a Zach Edey guy. He's just not a Zach Edey guy. It's an interesting question. The other thing, by the way, I wanted to raise before we go.
Yep.
Remember yesterday we were talking about the Halloween decorations in Germantown?
Yes.
This person has a skeleton. They've decorated the skeleton as a Christmas. They put red and green on the skeleton and said, hey, this is a Christmas decoration. And Germantown has cited them for leaving other Halloween decorations up too long. Just to summarize, okay? So we were discussing this yesterday. I asked Judge Jeffrey your ruling on this. Claire actually had this following point, which I think is a better point than either of us raised yesterday. The point of that regulation is to not have front yards be junky, ignored, trashy, whatever else, right? That is the point. Not people just lazily leaving stuff up, right? Not like, come on, man. Think about what you're... In fact, if that is the point... That is not at all what is happening here. This person is not being junky and leaving up crappy decorations for too long. They are intentionally, deliberately cultivating a certain look to their front lawn. There's nothing junky or it's winky or funny or whatever else. But if you look at what the spirit of the law is, it's not at all violating the spirit of the law. These people care about what their front yard looks like. And that's the point of the regulation.
Yeah, I agree with her. I also find myself, like, really not caring.
Well, there's definitely that.
But I definitely...
But Germantown cares.
I definitely think her point is valid in that this isn't just a, let's trash the front yard.
Okay, so let's trash the front yard or let's trash Taylor Jenkins. How much Taylor Jenkins trashing...
Let's focus on something positive. How are we stopping the run on Sunday at 5:30?
Yeah, I don't know. How much trashing of Taylor Jenkins is there going to be on these radio airwaves today?
I mean, I know from 2 to 4 there won't be a great amount. I don't know how Jason feels. I mean, there's no question. Like we said at the top of the show, that was an
37 minutes while being on the questionable list because he was sick. He would have had to sit out 3 minutes.
I guess my whole deal is like, we can also focus on this. Like there was an extreme lack of execution in the fourth quarter. The only quarter they didn't score 30 points or more was the fourth quarter.
And they couldn't stop them either.
Yes.
One of the points that Peter made is that it's not like the Rockets. I thought he said this sentence. He said the Grizzlies have the 3 best players in the game. He didn't mean like in the game.
In the game last night that we were watching.
Interesting perspective.
Yes.
If you were going to ask who are the 3 best players, we're going to have a draft of the 3 best players in this game. It might well be Grizzlies, 1, 2, 3. Yeah.
Easily.
Kind of fascinating. What is coming up next on 92.9?
Jeff, here's what's coming next on Jason and John. Jessica Benson will join Jason at 11:25. Jason Fitz, 125. Tim Murray with me today on Jeffrey Wright and Company. Jeff will be with Gabe at 5 o'clock.
Thanks for listening, buddy. We got to get out of here. Back tomorrow for now. Work's done.